On Friday, U.S. District Judge Barbara Crabb ordered county clerks in Wisconsin to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples, but she also ordered a stay on her decision while an appeal on the case is pending.
WPR reporter Gilman Halstead has been covering this story for Wisconsin Public Radio. He's with us now for the latest. Gilman, welcome back.
Thanks, Rob.
So do we have that right? She says, yes, my ruling means you have to issue these licenses, but my stay means you don't for now.
Right. Right now, her ruling is basically not in effect. It is stayed. She said other things in the ruling, too, of course. Mm-hmm. She said not only should the licenses be issued, but that she ordered the governor to tell all the department heads under him to address all of the things in state statutes that affect the legal status of marriage to make sure that they were enforced equally for same-sex couples as they are for different-sex couples. But that also is on hold.
Mm-hmm. So in that week between the original ruling and then what she had to say on Friday, a lot of people got marriage licenses, or at least think they did. Did last Friday's ruling clarify where they are now?
No, it really didn't. Something's come up today that will possibly have some effect on what the legal status of those marriages are, but there's definitely a disagreement. The state attorney general, J.B. Van Hollen, has said that he believes those marriages are not legal, or they are at least uncertain in their legal status, whereas the ACLU says, as happened in Utah, that at least at some level they do have legal force when it comes to federal benefits that are available to married couples.
And you mentioned something happening today on this front.
Right. We have state congressional members of Wisconsin's congressional delegation who wrote to Eric Holder, U.S. Attorney General, and said, please do what you did in Utah, which is to step in and say very clearly that those people who got married in that window, there mm-hmm. was a similar one in Utah, that they are eligible for the benefits they get through Social Security. They can file taxes together, those sorts of things that are under federal law.
And now from the Attorney General Van Hollen, what's next for him now? He had appealed the original decision. Where is he now?
Well, he needs to appeal it again, basically reappeal it, the way I understand it. And I actually did talk to his office today, and they just haven't filed it yet. We'll be getting notice, I would guess, within the next couple of days of them actually just refiling that. Because initially, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago sort of bounced it back up to Judge Crabb, saying that they didn't believe it was appealable until she finally ruled.
And then you heard from Governor Walker today. What are people asking him? What did he have to say?
Well, he's been an outspoken supporter of the ban in the past and says that he has voted for it. And so he was asked again, as he was on Friday, whether he'd changed his mind. He would not respond directly to that. He just said, it doesn't matter. It's not a matter of me changing my mind. As the governor, I don't have a role in this. It's the other two legs of the government, mm-hmm. the legislature and the courts. And right now it's in the courts who have responsibility. And whatever happens, we'll follow what the court says at this point.
It's going to be a winding path. Do you know how long it's going to be before there's a final decision?
Well, I talked to an attorney today that said either the Wisconsin case or one of the others that are now a little bit further along in the appeals process in one of, I think it's at least five other states, mm-hmm. Similar rulings have taken place, will eventually go to the Supreme Court. Wisconsin's could, but it's likely to be the first one at the head of the line. And that could be before the court in their next session, which begins in October, so that by this time next year, it's possible.
We'll probably talk to you about this many times between now and then. Thanks to Gilman Halstead, WPR reporter, for bringing us up to date on same-sex marriage in the courts.
Our next guest spent more than three decades working for the Central Intelligence Agency. Starting at the bottom, Jack Devine would go on to become the agency's acting deputy director of operations, meaning he was in charge of all the CIA spying operations.
In a new memoir, he looks back at his time overseeing some of the nation's most pivotal covert operations, as well as peeling back some of the mystery surrounding the agency. And while some question the CIA's role in today's society, he says covert operations, as opposed to costly and devastating full-scale military military interventions are the best safeguard of America's interests worldwide.
Jack Devine spent 32 years working for the CIA. He's currently the founding partner and president of the Arkin Group. He's the author of Good Hunting, an American Spymaster Story. And he joins us from Argo Studios in New York City. Jack, thanks so much for being with us today.
A pleasure to be here.
Well, you left the CIA and you're in the corporate intelligence business now, as you call it, but you couldn't stop turning over your years in the CIA. What do you think needs to be said or needed to be said for you before you could kind of move on?
Well, I'm not sure I could ever move on. And if you do an autopsy, you're going to find there's a piece of my heart that has the CIA seal. At least emotionally, I can't. And the book is driven basically from a reaction to a book that was written a few years ago saying that CIA is a rogue organization and covert action never works. And what I wanted to say is CIA is made up of public servants and people like your neighbors. And not only does covert action work, in the world that we're entering today, whether it's Syria, Ukraine, and Iraq or Afghanistan, we're not going to be putting troops on the ground and we're going to be looking at this traditional tool of statecraft more and more.
And as you said, you think that covert operations are more effective, more important to national interests than military, the military side of things, especially large-scale military maneuvers. Why is that?
Well, first of all, I would say that we have the finest military in the face of the earth, and our enemies understand that. I mean, I wouldn't worry about Putin or the terrorists not understanding how important that is. But I was in charge of the program to drive the Russians out of Afghanistan. And we did that without putting any troops on the ground. You have to have a fighting group. The indigenous people have to decide their future and they have to really want it. And I think that's a problem we're facing in Iraq. So where there is an indigenous people, we can support them. And where there isn't, then I suggest we not try to do nation building and put troops on the ground unless we are assaulted.
Now, you talked about one of the driving forces behind this book being your belief that rogue operations are not really a core part of the CIA. They don't happen very often. How did that idea about what happens in the CIA, the rogue agent, how did that idea persist?
Well, I think there's the romantic presentation of the CIA, which we can come back to later. I'm actually not uncomfortable with Hollywood on this point. The big concern, one of the really misunderstandings, I spent 32 years, but I also studied all of our covert action operations that preceded that. And I don't know of a single example, and I defy anybody to step forward and show me where there was a CIA operation that was not approved by the President of the United States. That's how tight the system is. And yet in the public mind, you know, we look to the CIA, and the truth of the matter is we usually have a policy problem. And again, the portrayal of the CIA as a rogue makes great movies, but poor history.
Well, there's so much that we could talk to you about. You spent 32 years in the CIA, so I want to kind of bounce around a little and touch on some different areas from your career. Among them, your take on the bin Laden capture, and you write that you weren't surprised that the U.S. captured and killed bin Laden in Pakistan, but you'd sort of expected it to happen about 10 years earlier. So how did that operation to catch bin Laden go astray, in your opinion?
Well, I actually misspoke. I hope I'm not today, but in December, you know, we had the 9/11 in September. And in December, I really was saying that, you know, before the winter comes, my guess is we would have our hands around bin Laden. I think there was and this is not a surprise, I remain baffled on why we went into Iraq. And I believe when you go to war, it just sucks so much energy and resources to war fighting that we reduced the emphasis on Afghanistan. And even there, we began to emphasize nation building in a country where I think I will be surprised if we don't run into similar problems as we're running into Iraq. So I knew we were going to get them. In fact, it's called good hunting because one of the core things about CIA is to hunt for bin Laden, hunt for Escobar, hunt for Kanzi. It's going after the mole in CIA. And it's an old slogan that we use among ourselves that go back, you know, to Kipling. And it's I often sign cables saying good hunting instead of break a leg or good luck.
You also talk about speaking truth to power. You consider that part of your job. Did you ever tell a sitting president we're getting off track here with Osama bin Laden?
I was gone at the time of 9/11, but I wrote what I thought was an important op-ed for saying that where is bin Laden? And this was about a year before the attack, and saying that he was basically on the lips and minds of the CIA and our special forces, but Washington wasn't paying enough attention. So that's just, you know, I'm not invited to the Oval Office and probably less likely today than ever. But it's the reason I pick up a pen, frankly, and it's to write op-eds. I had one on what I call the CIA solution, the Wall Street Journal, back in June or July of 2010, saying that, you know, we're going to face a problem in the end that we need to get out and leave behind CIA and special forces to try and maintain the best position we can. So I tried to make my voice heard, and I keep on, and that's why I'm on this wonderful radio program with you.
Well, we're talking right now with CIA veteran Jack Devine. He's written a new book about his 30-plus year career at the agency. And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We're talking with Jack Devine, author of Good Hunting, an American Spymaster story about his life and his career in covert operations for the CIA. And you can join the conversation with your questions for Jack at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And we'll go to our callers now. We have Kyle with us from Oconomowoc. Hi, Kyle.
Hello. I wanted to ask him what he knew about the Iran-Contra scandal, and was he a part of it?
All right, thank you. And Jack?
That's a good question. I actually go into it in some length in the book. It is the example of what I would call extremely poor covert action. And if you peel it apart, you start with the first point, that it was a presidential decision to make this transfer of TOW missiles to the Iranians. That was bad policy. And I was chief of the Iranian branch at the time, and I thought I had taken some initiatives to curtail that from happening. But the president did sign a finding, and we went forward with it. It was bad policy, but it wasn't illegal. What was illegal was that through the White House folks, they charged the Iranians double and sent half of the money to Central America to support the Contra effort there. That was in violation of the Boland Amendment, which broke the law. And that's what produced a huge scandal that almost brought down the Reagan administration. It was probably the lowest point in the administration. So it started with a backroom operation. And in the book, I go through what I consider good and bad covert action. One of those things is you have to be consistent with American wishes, and you have to coordinate you know, we don't like bureaucracies, but there's a purpose for it. You need to coordinate it so you don't have rogue operations. And this was a rogue operation, but it was a White House rogue operation supported by CIA.
So what else would you say it takes to have good covert operations?
Well, I think, you know, the Afghan program is a classic example of what I consider good covert action operation. American people were behind it. And I knew Charlie Wilson. I traveled with him, and we can talk about that. But it wasn't Charlie Wilson's war. It was a Republican president, Democratic Congress, if you can believe this, working together. You had a robustly funded program. You had experts, in the case of CIA, working with people on the ground that wanted to fight. And you put those combinations together, and you have the makings of good covert action, but not necessarily a good movie.
And you have said that Afghanistan looms especially large when you think back over your years, and some incredible stories out of that time. And I think among them what you're talking about here, ousting the Soviet Union from Afghanistan. Can you tell us a little bit about the part that you played?
Excuse me. I think the major fact, I was in charge of the Afghan program. So in 85, not many people realized this, there was a lack of optimism about our prospects of prevailing in Afghanistan. But the administration made a decision to really give it one more big shot. So we tripled the amount of weapons and arms, and including things like mules that I needed to transport the weapons. And the last 1,000 miles, I guess, was handled by these 9,000 mules that we marched across China. But the key here was the Stinger missile. And it was the first American weapon, and it changed history in that it shot down the Hind helicopters. And that day, the Russians started flying higher. And then the weapons poured across the border, and back in Moscow, they decided to throw in the towel. Little by little, I think it undermined the morale of the Soviet Union, combined with the economic failures and the tremendous pressure coming from the Reagan administration in the defense area. They just couldn't pull up their socks one more time. And it was ideologically based, and it was, at the end of the day, a stale ideology. So the Stinger missile, the fight there, really was a major factor, and all these things coming together to bring the end of the Soviet Union.
What do you make about the aftermath of American operations in Afghanistan? Should the U.S., do you think, have stuck around Afghanistan afterward and invested in rebuilding the country?
Charlie Wilson and I had long discussions. I actually worked on some plans to do that, and he was convinced that, you know, we should throw money in. However, when I stand back after 25 years, I think I was wrong. I think if we had thrown the money in, it would have not made a bit of difference. The country wasn't ready for change, and it was such a tribal area that you were almost inevitably going to end up with the conflict that ended up with the Taliban coming to power. So with a longer view of things, I know that's a criticism, but I think when I look at it and my own evolution and thinking about it, I don't think it would have made a difference. And that's why I'm so pessimistic and have been for 10 years about Iraq, and it's why I'm pessimistic about Afghanistan today.
I'm going to go back to our phone lines now and take a call from Daniel in Minong. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. Did the CIA believe Saddam had the infamous weapons of mass destruction that took us into the war in Iraq?
All right. Thank you, Daniel. Interesting question, and gets at some of the public relations problems that the CIA has had. What do you think?
Well, I think all of us. I don't know anybody. I've yet to meet anybody either in or out of government that didn't think that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. I think some of us thought there was less because there was an inspector program that did reduce some of the weapons of a fairly large amount of weapons of mass destruction, but it didn't explain where all they went. My problem wasn't whether or not they had weapons of mass destruction, and I don't think it really was fundamentally the CIA's problem, and I can talk about it in some length about how Saddam Hussein handled it. My problem was I didn't see anything that led to the immediacy of it. What was the urgency? What were we expecting? And I think at the time we were bogged down with the Taliban in Afghanistan, it was the wrong time to decide that something had to be done. I, to this day, as I said earlier, remain baffled. I don't understand why we had to, even if he had the weapons, move in. So it was the urgency that I have my biggest problem with.
And the intelligence came from a source named Curveball, that you dubbed Curveball, that was later discredited. And that kind of ricocheted back on the CIA. Looking back, would you have navigated those waters differently? Or was it just sort of outside of your purview?
Well, my experience with information, when you get such stunning information that you really have to go and kick the tires of the source. And in this case, it was a German source. And as I understand it, that reporting went and made its way into the president's briefing without that source having been met by a CIA official. When that source was met by a CIA official, he immediately decided that it was a fabricator. I worked with other directors where terrorist reports have come in, and they have insisted on getting to that source. So I think in retrospect, whenever the intelligence community puts its hands on a source that has sensational type of reporting that has to be dealt with force, someone has to sit down and go toe-to-toe with them. And I don't think, unfortunately, it happened in this case.
And Jack, we've got less than a minute left here, but given how you write about the CIA, the time in it, you said the CIA is tattooed on your heart. Do you think that the agency gets the trust and maybe the affection that it deserves from the American people?
I've been surprised over the years when you step out of the beltway in Washington, how much support there is for it. And I said, when you look at the movies where we started at the beginning, Hollywood's characterization of it, you know, at the end of the day, there's still a fascination with it. And it accrues to the agency's benefit. Not only do I not look like Sean Connery, but it enhances, you know, how one's perceived and how the agency's perceived. So I'm not worried about how America feels about the CIA. And there are blips, and we should be held accountable for sure. But I think Americans do understand they need this capability and that the people in there are really public servants that aren't much different than their relatives.
Jack, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on.
That was CIA veteran Jack Devine. His new memoir is called Good Hunting, an American Spymaster Story.